In our conversation today with a researcher and one of her subjects, a pregnant woman, both of them searching for links between the environment and autism. But first, this mountain is collapsing in slow motion, is how a Utah University official put it today. He was speaking about the relentless seismic activity at the Crandall Canyon mine in Utah that caused a second cave-in yesterday, killing 3 rescue workers, injuring at least 6 others, looking for the 6 miners still missing after the August 6th cave-in. Joining us, Ben Winslow, reporter for the Deseret Morning News in Utah. Ben, people in that area have got to be devastated.
It is absolutely devastating. You can see the anguish on people's faces. Even last night when this began, people who have family members who are miners participating in the rescue effort raced up here to the gates to try to get any information about their loved ones, to find out if they were the ones injured or possibly killed. The tears, it was something that was just heart-wrenching to watch, as people just that fear and that uncertainty, and also that feeling of, oh no, not again, because there's still the 6 trapped miners inside this mine, and now there are the 3 rescuers who have been killed.
Where are you now? Are you at the mine area? Where are you?
I am at the command post where the Emory County Sheriff's Office has set up. We're at the turnoff where the road leads up to the Crandall Canyon mine. Mm-hmm. The mine is still about a mile away from us. Last night, it was a chaotic scene as ambulance after ambulance after ambulance just came tearing up the canyon, mm-hmm. turning onto this road at a high rate of speed. Several medical helicopters were flown over the canyon and then landed directly on the mine property and then left a short time later carrying some of the injured rescuers.
Well, we know the rescue effort was halted after this, and Utah Governor John Huntsman is meeting with mine safety officials today, but he said he doesn't want the tunneling to resume. So that is the big question. Is it going to resume?
It's one of those situations where we've had another tragedy on top of a tragedy, and it just doesn't get any worse. But what do you tell the families of the 6 trapped miners? And then at the same time, what do you tell the families of those rescuers who died? It's kind of one of those situations where no matter what you do, there may not be the right answer.
Well, and who gets to decide that is, I guess, what I'm asking, because Governor Huntsman has said we've had enough injuries, but who can call off the search?
As I understand it, the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration has authority to do this. Certainly the mine owner, Bob Murray, will have a lot of input in that, and the governor himself will also have some input in a lot of that.
The rescue was still very far from the missing miners, where they're thought to be, 1,200 feet, more than half the distance to go. These seismic, they're called mountain bumps, I guess, have been happening, you know, since the first collapse. Do you get any sense? I mean, you've been able to talk to the rescuers and their families. Do you get a sense of whether they want to go back in?
We have not been able to talk to a lot of these rescuers, at least lately, to find out if they want to. We do know that some of the people in the community who have family members who are minors, who have been involved in some of the rescue efforts, have mixed feelings. Some people say, you know, this is a sign. Then others say, you know, we need to have faith and keep going and never give up. In these communities, there is a long tradition of mining. This is historically a mining area. It's Utah's coal country. And these types of tragedies are not unheard of. In 1984, 27 people were killed in a mine explosion in the Wilburg mine. People do kind of take it in stride, although you can tell this one is weighing very heavily on everyone in these communities.
And what about the related activity on top of the mountain, not inside the mountain, where rescue workers have been drilling that hole to put a camera into the area where these geophones, as they're called, had detected some unidentified waves on an audio wavelength that told them there might be some activity. Is that still going on, and have they detected anything?
That is still going on. In fact, that is the only part of the rescue effort that is still going on. We have not had an update of how far that progress has been. They have to drill almost 1,500 feet through a mountain to punch through into that cavern to be able to determine if this is the area where the 6 trapped miners are. But as far as the underground efforts, that has been halted. Everybody's out of the mine.
Ben Winslow, reporter for the Deseret Morning News, about a mile from the site of that mine collapse in Utah. Ben, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Finally, a large number of parents are saying someone is going to look into perfumes, pesticides, household cleaners, shampoos as possible causes of autism. This month, researchers in California announced a groundbreaking study on the environmental causes of autism, one of the most controversial questions in medicine. For years, there were questions about whether common childhood vaccines were responsible for autism, but after a mercury preservative was removed, the cases of autism didn't decline. And there is great debate over the role of other environmental factors. But what is clear to researchers and parents alike is that autism is prevalent in the U.S., with slightly more than 5 in 1,000 affected. And recently, a California study showed that women who lived near farm fields sprayed with a particular pesticide gave birth to children with autism at much higher rates. So it's against this backdrop that Irva Hertz-Pichovto has undertaken a study of pregnant women who've offered to gather extensive data before their child is born, with the hope of understanding what happens if they do have a child with autism. Joining us on the line first, Dr. Hertz-Pichovto, an epidemiologist with the University of California Davis Mind Institute. Welcome.
Thank you.
In a moment, we're going to be joined by one of your moms, but tell us first what we're talking about. Define autism, and while we're at it, Asperger's syndrome.
Sure. Autism is a lifelong developmental disorder, which is characterized by three core sets of symptoms. The first is in the area of social communications, deficits in the ability to interact socially. The second is in communications, and the third is repetitive behaviors or restricted sets of interest.
In other words, some of the children that we've seen with autism, I mean, their symptoms, if you will, range from not being able to interact or speak or communicate at all to what?
Well, autism is part of a spectrum of disorders, and the other disorders that are on that spectrum include Asperger's syndrome, which is a milder form, and pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified. Autism is a more severe form than Asperger's, and while there are some people with autism who are quite high-functioning, the vast majority are not.
You've been studying autism for a while. In fact, you began the pilot program about a year ago called Markers of Autism Risk in Babies, Learning Early Signs, or MARBLES. It was just formally launched by UC Davis a week ago. What's different about this study? What is it that you as researchers are acknowledging?
Well, I think the early origins of this disorder and the fact that the disorder probably originates at some point during pregnancy. Now, there is a lot of discussion and debate about the relative importance of genes versus environment. And here at Davis, we take the position that it's both. And probably most cases of autism are a combination of genetic influences and environmental mm-hmm. factors. Most of the research that has been done on causes has been focusing on just the genes.
Yeah. This is validating for a lot of parents, isn't it? Because they've just felt this is true, that it's more than genetic.
Yeah, a lot of parents have been supportive of looking in this direction. The scientific community, if you go back several decades, really adhered to the idea that the problem with autism really started with bad parenting. And this was the paradigm for several decades. That's changed, but there's still this legacy, I think, with many parents feeling that the scientific world is against them.
That comes from the battle, and we should mention this as well, over the preservative thimerosal in vaccines. A lot of parents felt that this was the culprit. The Institute of Medicine did a big study and says no, but some parents are still, you know, taking that accusation to court. You know, what say you about that complaint of parents? Because we've read where some researchers are saying that's what put some researchers off from environmental factors because the preservative and vaccines had been discounted and they didn't want, you know, their work sort of tarnished by that.
Well, I don't think it's quite at the point where the idea of vaccines is completely out of the question. If there is a role, it's probably in a small susceptible subset. In other words, I'm not saying that autism is caused by vaccines at all. I'm just saying that there may be a subset of children, and we haven't identified who that subset might be. But at this point, there's not evidence yet. I think the possibility that a mercury dose at a critical time point might be one among many, many other factors.
Well, in the meantime, these are the questions you're trying to answer. Tick off some of the things that you're considering in your study. What are you looking at?
A wide range, and this includes both chemical agents, which could be in everything from household products to cosmetics to cleaners to pesticides. And then besides the chemical compounds, we're also interested in the role of microbiological factors. A little known fact is that there have been a few studies conducted some time ago showing two environmental factors that play a role in autism. And neither one of them is likely to be playing a role today. The first one is congenital rubella. In the early 1970s, there was an epidemic.
Measles.
Yeah, or German measles. And at that time, the children who were born having been exposed congenitally had a much higher risk of developing autism. That's a virus. So microbiological agents can result in autism. And the other factor was thalidomide. Now, thalidomide was a drug that was used to prevent spontaneous abortion. It was never used in the U.S., and it was associated with very severe malformations, absence of limbs, of arms and legs. And it was found that in a small subgroup of the thalidomide-exposed babies, autism developed. It does tell us that both chemical and biological factors could result in this common set of behaviors.
Well, and you are going back to the beginning in your study rather than trying, as researchers have been doing for the past couple of decades, to piece together the pieces, you know, a mystery when a child, as a child grows. You are trying to look at the beginning, and you're working with women who have pregnancies and who have at least one child already who's autistic. And we have one of those women on the line. Nancy Dooley is a California mother of three. One of them has autism. Nancy, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Nancy, I know your youngest, Jordan, is now 7 weeks old, but when you were pregnant with Jordan, you were in the study. First of all, what is your thinking? You know, what was your reaction knowing that UC Davis and IRVA were going to be taking a look at environmental causes?
I was thrilled.
So your oldest daughter, Kira, how old is she now, by the way?
She's six.
She's six and has autism. Can you describe how that, you know, that appears in her?
She's a very affectionate child, but she also has some behavior problems where just this morning I had to intervene when she bit her younger sister, and she can be aggressive at times. She can bang her head. She used to make herself throw up. She will cry and hold her head, and we don't really know why. She has a lot of digestive problems that we've had to address with special diets that have helped her. And she still hasn't developed spoken language, but we are understanding more and more through some nonverbal IQ tests that she has a very high level of intelligence, even though on the verbal IQ test she scores very low because she doesn't have the ability to verbalize her thoughts.
That's Nancy Dooley, a California mom, participating in this groundbreaking study on the causes of autism, which is so affecting her own daughter. We're going to hear much more from her and from Dr. IRVA Hertz-Pichotto on what factors they're looking for. Much more after a break here and now. Speaking with researcher Dr. IRVA Hertz-Pichotto from the University of California, Davis, her new study looking at environmental factors that pregnant women are exposed to in the hopes of pinpointing the causes of autism. And we've also been speaking with Nancy Dooley of California. Her eldest daughter, Kira, has autism. Nancy participated in an earlier study with Kira, and she and her newborn daughter, Jordan, are now part of Dr. Hertz-Pichotto's new study. The acronym is MARBLES. And Nancy, you know, many mothers tell us when autism is diagnosed, they blame themselves. When Kira was diagnosed, did you do the same or wonder, why is this happening?
Absolutely. You know, Kira developed typically for the first year. There was never, ever a question. And then slowly after her first birthday, she declined. By, you know, 20 months, she was diagnosed with autism. And of course, when you lose that connection with a child so young, you do wonder what happened.
Did you ever think you knew, or what were some of the things you wondered about?
My poor husband has had to endure all of my half-cooked ideas and theories, ranging from microwaves to antibacterial soap to food additives, vaccines. I mean, the pesticides, plasticizers, the list goes on. And I feel that this study, I was so excited because when this happened, when she was diagnosed, I, of course, thought, you know, what did she get exposed to?
What are things that you've been asked in the current study, in fact? What are some of the things that you're asked about?
Oh, I'm asked about makeup, face powder, conditioner, astringents for your face, body cleansers. Let's see.
Dr. Hirst-Picciotto, I'm going to bring you back in. What are some of the other things? I mean, it sounds like, I mean, when you think about it, there could be hundreds of questions about what we use that you could ask.
Right. There are thousands of chemicals that are introduced into everyday consumer products, and we use them all the time. As Nancy pointed out, there are things in soaps, in cosmetics. There are chemicals in our textiles, in the curtains, in the carpeting that we have. There are chemicals used on the plastic casings of electronics, for example, television sets, computers, printers, and so forth. The testing of chemicals is mostly focused on acute toxicity and carcinogenicity. And really, there are very few regulations that require testing for neurodevelopmental damage.
Well, Nancy, as we said, you now have your 7-week-old. What were some of the tests that you physically took while you were carrying Jordan?
When I was pregnant, they do a blood draw in each of the trimesters. And they also have you do a urine collection once a week for 4 weeks in each of the trimesters. So 24 hours prior to doing your urine collection, you keep track of every food that you eat, what time you ate it, how much you ate, what all the ingredients were, and whether it was organic or not. Now they're starting to ask if it's canned or not. And then you also fill out a retrospective 48-hour chemical exposure checklist. There's I think it's 104 questions, and it asks your exposure to everything from, you know, the makeup, and if you've had your nails done, been to a beauty salon, got your hair dyed.
This is a lot of work, Nancy.
It's great, though. I'm so excited that somebody else has taken this over, because I've been in my own head cooking this up for years.
Really, really.
As
a parent, you were thinking of you know, that this should be done.
Absolutely. I've driven myself crazy with the amount of research I've done over the years online, trying to find out what different chemicals do to a developing body. You want to know what caused it so that you might be able to have an answer to how to help.
Would it also help if you knew that, you know, in effect, do you feel that you caused it, you know, because...
I don't blame myself. I did not do anything on purpose, obviously, and I don't think any parent should blame themselves, although that is, you know, guilt is a parenting... Guilt is just a part of parenthood, but I think... For me, I did feel a sense of responsibility.
Dr. Hirst-Picciotto, do you have any preliminary results? I mean, is there any findings so far that have caught your interest?
Not yet from the marble study. We're really just launching that one. From the charge study, we are beginning to see some actually interesting things with regard to mechanisms. We think of autism as being a neuropathologic condition. In other words, there's a pathology in the brain. But in fact, it seems to be multi-system. And you just heard Nancy talking a little bit about the GI symptoms, that her child has a lot of difficulty with foods. Well, in addition, what we are finding in the CHARGE study is that the immune systems of children with autism do not function as well as the immune systems in typically developing children. Now, this is new. There's something really quite unusual and perhaps even pervasive with regard to immune function. So what we're seeing is that maybe there's an immunologic component to autism, which means that we have to widen our net to not just think of chemicals that could affect the nervous system directly, but chemicals that might affect the immune system and therefore influence the nervous system.
How much would you as a researcher love to have the, you know, the bingo moment?
Well, we're hoping to find some bingo moments. I don't think there's going to be one smoking gun here. I think there's going to be a lot of incremental illumination, we're going to find that there's a little bit of an increase from chemical A that might be with exposure that happens in the first trimester, or there might be a little bit of an increment from such and such a medical procedure that may happen, you know, just around the time of birth. And again, I'm not discounting genes, because these genes do have an effect, and there is an interaction between genes in the environment.
Nancy, you've already said what you hope to find, just, you know, some answers. Meantime, you have three daughters, your six-year-old with autism, your middle child, autism-free, and your seven-week-old. I just wonder, what's that like for you? I mean, how closely are you watching Jordan?
I'm watching her under a microscope, of course, unfortunately for her. But I also think, you know, if we have another child with autism, I've done everything again that I knew. I've changed so many things that, you know, if she does develop autism, it's okay. I love my other daughter with autism. I'm sure this would be another challenge, but she is being watched very closely, and luckily the study is also watching her, too.
Well, Nancy Dooley, we wish you the best.
Thank you.
And Dr. Hertz-Pichotto, thank you so much for talking to us about the MARBLES study. If people want to learn more, they can go to our website, here-now.org. But in the meantime, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, much more ahead after the break and the news, here and now. In a dramatic bid to ease the credit crisis and calm financial markets, the Federal Reserve today cut its interest rate on loans to banks by half a percentage point. Now, that move is expected to help businesses, including mortgage companies that are having trouble getting loans for their own short-term financing. But it's less clear whether the move is going to trickle down to consumers or boost the sluggish housing market. So, what to do when your house doesn't sell? We might turn to home staging. Here Now's Kurt Nickisch learned about it firsthand when the place he was renting here in Massachusetts went on the market.
I've been renting a single-family home in Brighton until my landlords decided to sell, and call me crazy, I actually let them move in furniture and decorate it to show to prospective buyers while I was still living there. In came Daisy, home stager extraordinaire. She set out candles as big as fire hydrants, bundles of willows leaned in corners, African bowls hung in the kitchen like red peppers. Overnight, I was living in a Pottery Barn showroom.
Whoa. Yeah, this is not my house.
Daisy knew what I was feeling. She'd seen this before. Her full name is Daisy Riley, and she does this for a living. So it's not the first time she's made a catalog centerfold from a bachelor pad.
A single man, definitely. You know, very sparse furnishings usually. Maybe one or two nice pieces a girlfriend gave them or the parents gave them. But, you know, mostly it's utilitarian.
Great. Thanks, Daisy. But the point is that while utilitarian might be good for living in a house, it's deadly for showing one.
It's like a movie set or styling a, you know, a set for a commercial or a photo shoot. You know, you're capturing a moment in time that's idealized.
The way she did that in my place was by carting to the basement everything that wasn't
pretty
or
sparkly
or
fluffy.
Basically, my whole living room, starting with the bookshelves.
You know, there are a lot of paperbacks and a lot of not necessarily pretty on the outside books. Content-wise, I'm sure they were very nice, but for something like this, you want attractively covered books.
In their place, she put out just a handful of hardcovers, one on antiques, one on mythology, you know, the type, coffee table books. The one on feng shui matched the terracotta Buddha she poised on the fireplace mantle.
So I'm curious, which Buddha is that, do you know?
I don't.
Not important.
We're not necessarily looking for serious Buddhists.
Just people who like to think of themselves as spiritual. Now, home staging's not all semblance and ego petting. Daisy crafted the living room with low-slung couches that made the room seem bigger than it is, and they somehow managed to face the fireplace, which is in a weird spot off to the side. But much of the furnishing is there really just to create mood. The glass-colored ornaments, the vases, orchids, of course, they speak of warmth. Some home stagers don't like photos. They prefer to depersonalize the space. But Daisy likes pictures, as long as they're, you know,
pretty.
So she set out photos that look like the kind you see in store-bought frames. People fishing in the tropics, beaming children, parents who are young and tan.
Who are those yuppies?
These are just from magazines. You know, these are the people we hope buy the house. You know, a young couple, that have a young son, and they're walking clearly in an urban setting.
Affluent, yes. Urban setting.
Yes, yes.
They're all smiling. They look happily married.
They do, yes.
The kid is having a good time, but not misbehaving.
Exactly. It's the ideal. And once again, not probably what most people look like on a Sunday afternoon strolling in the park, but what they hope they look like.
All this pretending, all this embellishing, all this judging books by their cover, well, it may have paid off, even though it cost $3,500. The real estate agent, Hannah Abrams, says this house sold just below the asking price.
I thought the difference between not staging and staging for this property would be about $20,000. But because the staging was so great, I think they're more likely to net an additional $30,000. Staging didn't come for free. But whatever investment they put in, they're getting, I don't know, 5 times, 10 times more than they put into it.
What's more, the house sold in just 10 days.
So, yeah, my reaction was, this is just such a nice house. But I didn't think it's been staged.
That's Ed Perlmutter. He's the one buying the house.
It felt neat and tidy and organized and all of the things that I want to be. Maybe if I lived there, I could be like that. I mean, I think, again, at some level, I did think that.
Ed admits the staging helped him fall in love with the place and made him more willing to boost his offer. He was actually so taken with it, he hired Daisy to stage his old house, the one he's moving out of.
Hi.
Yes.
Hello, Daisy.
How are you?
Good. How are you? Welcome to the mess.
I went along when Daisy checked out Ed's house. They went room to room talking about what could stay and what had to go.
If the sushi stuff is pretty, we could
put it out.
Maybe put it up.
Display it somehow. Right. And then here, is that too many tchotchkes?
Yes.
Okay.
But there's just a lot of things going on. So maybe we could unify the theme a little bit, you know?
A decanter with rum in it, well, that could stay, but the vodka bottles had to go. So did the cats. So did the wall hanging of Cher. Where Ed's stuff wouldn't do, he'd have to rent furniture and decorations from Daisy. She also told him to get white towels for the bathrooms.
Interesting.
New towels look nice.
New towels really do make an impression, huh?
Yes.
Who knew?
They're fluffier.
Who knew?
I knew.
As Ed and Daisy stepped over half-packed boxes and cans of paint, I got an appreciation of the clutter chaos and cellar stress that Daisy will soon turn into a soothing catalog scene.
How do we feel about this bright yellow?
The bright yellow was just painted, Daisy, and it's not going anywhere.
Okay.
It was a color choice that was made that is, we're here. We're here with the yellow.
All right. Well, we'll work with the yellow then.
And Daisy did. I went back a week after Ed's house went on the market, and the home had already sold. A young woman fell in love with it at first sight.
When she saw this house on a given Thursday afternoon, 4 days after it went on the market, it was looking pretty shiny.
Getting it shiny cost him, of course. In all, Ed says he paid Daisy $1,500. Practically, he's also paying for the $3,500 to stage the house he's buying, the one I was renting. And that's what I think is curious about this whole home staging thing. You pay a lot for something that just gets hauled off before you even move in. Basically, it's a transaction cost. It's like giving your real estate agent another 1% commission. But it doesn't bother Ed.
Seems like a pretty good thing.
In this market, he's just happy with the house he's getting and thrilled to be rid of the one he had, quick and clean.
You know, the staging that went on at the house I'm buying, the staging that went on here, that was all sort of part of the good equation.
Another good part, Ed says, is the lesson he learned. He felt so inferior for living the unpretty, unsparkly, unfluffy life he did.
My new mantra since this whole thing happened is WWDD, which stands for What Would Daisy Do? You know, so I have an awareness, but what Daisy does, I cannot do. Not at her caliber.
So Ed's planning on hiring Daisy to help decorate his new house. He wants his real life to approach the idealized life of the house he paid for.
That's Kurt Nickisch, who produced our piece on home staging. If you want to see photos of a home as it was staged for sale, go to our website, here-now.org. Don't forget, while there, you can download a podcast. Take us with you wherever you go. And before we go, composer John Adams. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, we have some time for some of your thoughts. This week, we spoke with Jeff Goodell, the author of Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. We spoke about the high price we pay to mine and burn coal for electricity in lives, as we see today, and environmental damage. William Riley of Meridian, New Hampshire, wanted to underscore that second point. He writes, "What about the disposal of the ash or slag after the coal is burned? I once asked a chemistry professor if it would make more sense to take all the money invested in the nuclear power industry, which has no great disposal solution, and instead invest in state-of-the-art chimney scrubbers to make coal burn cleaner. Well, that professor gave me the stats. Railroad car after railroad car of waste from electric plants each day. A major disposal problem with heavy metal ingredients which are toxic to the environment." We also spoke this week with Phoenix, Arizona meteorologist Kaylee O'Kelly about the heat wave and the urban heat island effect, cities getting much hotter than the surrounding suburbs and acting as heat walls that block incoming rainstorms until one explodes through, as happened in Phoenix this week. Well, Peter Newton of Phoenix wrote us about it. He says, "I was rattled out of bed as lightning danced around my neighborhood, setting off car alarms, rattling the building. It was something. When I lived in St. Louis, we watched the radar as approaching storms made a beeline for downtown, only to then see them buffeted by this bubble, taking routes around the city before returning to the original course, sort of like a traveler taking a bypass. Architects and planners have been researching means to reduce the effects of urban heat island effect, tree planting in Chattanooga, painting roofs and streets white in other cities to deflect the heat. Do a story on this." Okay, we will. Armando Garma Fernandez of Brooklyn, New York, wrote after our story on a Stanford University study which claimed that children actually thought that food tasted better when it was wrapped in McDonald's paper rather than a plain brown wrapper. Well, Armando writes, "Who could blame them? I'm no fan of McDonald's. I do, however, believe in the power of presentation. If I arrive at a job interview wearing shorts and sandals, I doubt I'd receive an offer versus someone dressed in a suit, even if our resumes were identical." We also spoke recently with the folks from the surplus property divisions of Georgia and Pennsylvania about items that have been confiscated by airline security and put up for sale. Now, they expressed surprise at the number of auto parts that have been confiscated from air travelers, to which Roger Shelton of New Hampshire responded, "Sure, I can see why state officials were surprised to find a fuel pump in a carry-on bag, but I'm even more surprised that security officials would consider a fuel pump to be a weapon. Nobody move. I have a fuel pump and nothing to lose. I know. I do feel safer now, but..." And finally, during our conversation with Here Now's pop culture critic Renee Graham about the evolution of the rock star Prince, we mentioned that Renee is one of the few journalists to have interviewed his royal badness, and she said he was the best-smelling human being she's ever been in the presence of, to which listener Allison Heiberger of Bend, Oregon responded, "Well, what did he smell like? Cologne, aftershave, flowers, fruit, peppermint? I'm dying to know." Renee is on the line. Renee, how did Prince smell?
I would say it's a calming hint of lavender, a whiff of cinnamon, reminiscent of my grandmother's apple pie on Thanksgiving morning, chocolate chip cookies. Every scent you love, that's what he smelled like. I could have inhaled that man all day.
Yeah, but that would have been embarrassing, Renee, as if this wasn't. Renee, thanks.
Thanks, Robin.
The lights go out. The lights go out. The smell of doom. It's creeping into your lonely room. The bed's on fire. Your fate is sealed. And you're so tired. And the reason is Camille, Camille, Shakadelica.
And Renee picked this Prince selection, Shakadelica. So obviously we answer any questions, welcome any comments. Our address is letters@here-now.org, or you can give us a call at 617-358-0397. Please, remember to give us your full name and hometown.
She got you tied with a golden rope. She won't let you play your guitar. And when you cried enough, maybe she'll let you up for nasty riding.
By the way, according to Renee, Prince was a big fan of Jimi Hendrix. Well, that's at least one thing Prince and classical composer John Adams have in common. We'll hear from him after a break here and now. Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And that, of course, is Jimi Hendrix, 38 years ago tomorrow at Woodstock. And you can draw a direct line from that sound to this one.
When I shook hands with Joe and Lai, when I shook hands with Joe and Lai, on this bare field outside Peking, just now the whole world was listening.
That's Nixon in China by American composer John Adams. For the past several decades, Adams has been a major figure on the classical contemporary music scene. He's embraced symphonies, operas, choral works. In 2003, he won a Pulitzer Prize for On the Transmigration of Souls, which included text from missing persons posters in a moving reflection on 9/11.
Date of birth, July 9th, 1963. Wait. 180 pounds.
John Adams was educated at Harvard, where he returned this spring to receive the Harvard Arts Medal. That's where we caught up with him to talk about his influences, from experimental musician John Cage to minimalist Philip Glass to Jimi Hendrix. That's what we wanted to ask about. We heard that when he was at school, his head was full of the modern composer Arnold Schoenberg, when Jimi Hendrix's music floated through a window.
Hey, Joe, where you going with that gun of yours?
That happened so often that I can't remember a specific moment, but it was a kind of emblematic experience that I would be, you know, stuck in the bowels of the music department worrying about some very dissonant piece of European music that I actually had very little interest in, and then I would walk across Harvard Yard and hear this fantastic Dionysian powerful music of rock. And finally, you know, I one day just kind of came to and said, there's something wrong with this picture. You know, I really have to get away from this Eurocentric approach to classical contemporary music. So I got in a car and drove across the country to San Francisco to sort of seek my spiritual fortune, I guess.
Was there ever a thought that you might switch completely to Hendrix or one of those other sounds, that you might leave classical?
Never. Actually, no. I love the classical canon, and I always felt myself to be a composer of written music and music that would work within the format of orchestral and operatic literature.
So what would you say you actually did? I mean, it's very simplistic to say, and aha, you combined some of the sounds of the day with classical sounds.
I at first was a big follower of John Cage and did a lot of events in San Francisco that were very kind of free-form, messy, more philosophically interesting than aesthetically interesting. But I was searching for my own voice, and I think it finally came largely through just a general maturing, both of my musical technique and of my myself as a person. Also, in the mid-70s, I heard my first minimalist pieces. I heard pieces by Steve Reich and Philip Glass and Terry Riley, and that seemed to point in a really very, very fruitful direction for me.
By the way, for those who aren't followers, define that. What do you mean by minimalism?
Well, minimalism we use as a sort of blanket term to describe a music that's characterized by three things. One is that it has a very clear, stable sense of pulse. You know, you tap your toe to it. It has a harmonic sense, but the changes in harmonies tend to be very gradual. You might stay on a single harmony for, you know, minutes. And finally, it's a music that builds its large-scale architecture through reiteration or repetition of very small motives. But I wanted the music that also was able to be much more dramatic, it could turn on a dime. So I wanted to find a music that had the energy of American culture, that had the pulsation, the life. Fundamentally, American culture, even to this day, compared to European culture, is still optimistic.
Tell us more what your early influences were. I mean, here we are at Harvard where, you know, you studied writing music, but what else was influencing you?
Well, I grew up in a really small town, East Concord, New Hampshire. There were about 300 people there, so I was very limited in my exposure to live music. I learned the canon through listening to LPs and collecting them. That's how I learned Beethoven and Stravinsky and Bartok and Ives. You know, I remember being in a local record store one day in New Hampshire and picking up this LP that had a beautiful scene of snow and pine trees, and that sort of looked like home, and it was a composer named Sibelius that I'd never heard of, but I thought, gee, if that looks like my backyard, maybe I'd like the music. So I bought it and took it home, and Sibelius, in fact, turned out to be an immensely important composer for me.
How do you feel about the current crop of young people studying to be composers? Are you encouraged? Because you just don't hear a lot in, popular press, you know, young people wanting to be composers. And I'm just wondering, is it out there?
It is absolutely out there. And one of the most aggravating and annoying phrases that I hear these days is the death of classical music. I just came here to Harvard from being at Yale, the Yale School of Music, and I heard performances of my music there that I can tell you without any hyperbole or exaggeration were among the best performances of my music I've heard anywhere in the last 30 years. And most interestingly, they're still interested in writing for orchestra, which I really was pronouncing a dead art form. I just didn't see the orchestra being a setting that would attract young composers who'd grown up listening to Radiohead and hip-hop. But in fact, there's a huge interest on the part of young people to continue the classical tradition. We call it classical not because we want to think of guys in wigs, but I call it classical because I want to think that what I do is going to be meaningful 100 years or 200 years from now. And that when somebody who does live 200 years from now listens to my music, they'll get the feeling of, that's what it felt like to be alive in 2007. It's through the arts that we create our culture. And when we want to think back over the history of the human species, it's through their art. I mean, when we think about the Mayans and we think about the Chinese, and we think about all these cultures from a long time ago, it's through their art that we understand them.
We caught up with composer John Adams at Harvard University, and this is one of his two fanfares for orchestra. For a complete list of all the music you heard, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time.